The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, welcome everybody to the first Sunday morning session of Socialism 2010. I'm Courtney from Pittsburgh. I'll be chairing. Adam Turrell is a member of the ISO in Carbondale and a contributor socialist worker, and his talk will be the Eugene Debs Rebellion, the 1894 Pullman Strike.
Okay.
Hooray!
All right, Sunday morning, it's all coming the way I thought it would. I want to start out with a quote from Sidney Lenz from the Labor Wars, from his chapter on the Pullman Strike. And what Lenz says is, the closest America has come to revolution, although aside from the other two revolutions, has been in the labor wars, each one of which has been, in a sense, a revolution in microcosm. The strikers in these industrial flare-ups confronted not only the power of their employers, but ultimately that of the state, the government, courts, police, and militia. To succeed, they had to neutralize the administrative machinery of the government, and in the process, there was also the possibility of a widening and escalating of the conflict to a point where it might border on insurrection. And I think what Sidney Lenz does, he sort of encapsulates two of the reasons why a talk on a 106-year-old strike is important. I mean, after all, we're in the midst of our own battles, struggling against budget cuts, layoffs, oppression of minorities, and so on. But I think part of our struggle is also ideological, right? Part of our struggle is against the ruling ideas of societies, and one of those ruling ideas is what's often called American exceptionalism, right? That the United States is a different kind of society than Europe or Latin America or any place else. There's not as much class struggle and so on, which is simply not true. So commemorating the long history of class struggle in the United States is in and of itself an important political thing to do. And secondly, it's through the lessons of struggles like the Pullman Rebellion, the Debs Rebellion, that we come to have a better understanding in part of struggles today. And this strike was full of lessons. One about the relationship of the state to struggle. What side is the government really on when it comes down to it? The relationship of economic crisis to class struggle, and how workers are always made to pay for economic crisis, and also how people's ideas, including the ideas of Eugene Debs, are shaped and changed in the course of struggle. And also the 1894 Pullman strike is a great history of sort of two paradigmatic figures. On the one hand, Eugene Debs, who sought to build one of the first industrial unions in the United States, the American Railway Union, and who became a militant labor leader and a socialist. And on the other hand, George Pullman, who was sort of representative of the robber barons of the golden or the gilded age. Now, eventually, Eugene Debs would become one of the most famous socialists in U.S. history. But in 1894, Debs was not yet a socialist. At 14, he was still relatively young. He was in his 30s by the time of the Pullman strike. At age 14, Debs had gone to work on the railroads. He quit when he was 18 on the insistence of his mother after a close friend of his was crushed by a locomotive and killed while they were at work. He went to work in a grocery store, but nonetheless, he joined something called the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen. Within about a year, he became secretary treasurer, or a couple years, he became secretary treasurer of the union, the editor of the BLF's journal, the magazine it was called, and he was touring the country before long, signing up thousands of new members to join the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen. And this is important because after the rail strikes that happened in the 1870s, I don't know if people are familiar, there was a huge strike wave amongst railroad workers in 1877. There was blacklisting of all sorts of anybody who was remotely connected to labor organizations, and membership had plummeted. And Eugene Debs set out to rebuild the BLF. And it's important for folks to understand that there was lots of different railroad brotherhoods at the time when Debs was first getting involved in the labor movement. And they weren't necessarily full-fledged unions the way we might think of them today. A lot of the brotherhoods didn't consider themselves organizations. They were against strikes, a lot of them, or most of them. They didn't want to negotiate with the bosses particularly. They considered themselves to be benevolent societies where they would get insurance for their members. And they're also divided along craft lines. So every different kind of job on the railroad belonged to a different kind of brotherhood. And this was a major weakness. So the employers always could play the railroad workers off of each other. The firemen on the one side, the brakemen on another, the engineers, the conductors, and so on. But they also weren't static. People challenged some of the more conservative things inside the brotherhoods, and eventually Eugene Debs did as well. In 1886, during the fight for the 8-hour day that swept the country, that gave us May Day and the Haymarket Martyrs, and so on, railroad workers challenged the no-strike policy of their brotherhoods. In fact, they threw out the entire leadership of the BLF, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, except for Eugene Debs and one other person, and got rid of their no-strike clause. And Debs tried to resign, but they wouldn't let him because he was so popular amongst the workers, and they ordered him to go to the railroad bosses and tell them that they were now a full-fledged union, and so on. And Debs' ideas were also starting to change, too, throughout all this period. He started to see these divisions between the different brotherhoods, the different groups of workers, divided on craft lines as a major weakness, and he decided he wanted to create a federation to bring together all the different brotherhoods. And he pursued this goal full-time. He still, even up to right around this time, he was against strikes, thinking that strikes were bad for both bosses and workers, but he changed his mind about that at this time as well, and he started arguing that the strike is the weapon of the oppressed, of men capable of appreciating justice and having the courage to resist wrong and contend for principle. So, by late 1880s, Debs is working around the clock to try to build this federation, touring the country, giving countless speeches, writing editorials in the magazine, the journal of the BLF. And that in 1889, the leaders of three of the brotherhoods rail workers got together in Chicago and formed what they called the Supreme Council of the United Orders of Railway Employees. I love the Supreme Council. It sounds like something that would fight the Legion of Doom. And this was a joint executive of the brotherhoods. But each brotherhood remained independent and could do its own thing as well. It had to be unanimous if they would actually take joint action. And at first, this unity that was beginning to brew amongst the brotherhoods made the railroads sing a more conciliatory tune and actually give some good contracts. But they also set out to divide the brotherhood immediately because its federated nature was still a weakness. They could still buy off one brotherhood and the leadership of one brotherhood to scab on another in a strike. And this federation came to an end with a strike in Buffalo, where train workers went on strike to demand enforcement of the law. New York State had a 10-hour day law that you couldn't have to work more than 10 hours a day. The railroad workers were working 14 hours a day. They went on strike to demand enforcement of the law. The governor called out 6,000 National Guard, well, militia is what they were called back then, to bust the strike. And after this happened, unfortunately, the brotherhood scabbed on one another during the strike. A strike was defeated and the federation was torn apart. And so Debs decided federation wasn't good enough. He was totally dedicated to the idea of improving the lot of railroad workers, and he concluded that there needed to be a union that brought together all the railroad workers, regardless of craft, regardless of the job they had, and united them together. So he set out to form what they called the American Railway Union, the ARU, which was one of the first industrial unions in U.S. history, and it grew rapidly, partly because Debs was so immensely popular. He had stood up to the bosses at personal risk, and he could get a hearing with railroad workers all around the country, and there were also hundreds of thousands of less skilled railroad workers who couldn't get into the brotherhoods, couldn't afford the high dues, and so on, who were desperate for organization. And so as Ray Ginger put it, who wrote the biography A Bending Cross of Eugene Debs, he said, it seemed that every underpaid railroader in the country, and there were nearly a million of them, wanted to join the order. The officers were unable to pass out charters fast enough to keep pace with the applications. Entire lodges of the railway common and switchmen transferred to the ARU. Firemen, conductors, even engineers, who were relatively better paid, joined the industrial union. But the great majority of recruits came from previously unorganized men who had been unable to meet the high monthly dues of the brotherhoods. Within 20 days of founding this new union, the ARU had 34 locals and was signing up between 200 and 400 members a day, and it had three paid organizers to organize all this. It faced its first major strike almost right away in conflict in St. Paul, Minnesota, on the Great Northern train line, and they won the battle, and that only increased the reputation and profile and prestige of the ARU, and thousands of more workers joined the ARU. Now, the ARU was a big step forward in a lot of ways. It was more democratic than most unions at the time. The net officers were elected by the membership and so on. There was an industrial union that united all the different crafts together. But there are also some turds that can't be polished when it comes to the ARU. And most importantly, they excluded black workers. This was contentious, and there were arguments about it in the ARU, but they excluded black workers. A vote to remove the racist rule was narrowly defeated, actually, at the first convention. There were also organizational problems with the ARU. On the one hand, there's this sudden mass influx of workers, thousands of gung-ho workers who wanted to fight the bosses, who wanted to have a better shake, but had almost no experience organizing unions and so on, joining overnight the ARU. And on the other hand, you had a tiny group of leadership around Eugene Debs. No secondary leadership in between this mass of new members, or if there was a secondary, it wasn't organized, and so on, in the union. And this is sort of the state of the union on the eve of the Pullman strike. Now, I want to talk a little bit about George Pullman and the Pullman Corporation. George Pullman was the founder and CEO of the Pullman Corporation, and he made his fortunes off the railroads, actually after making a decent amount of money moving buildings from the Erie Canal expansion in New York and raising buildings in Chicago after the Chicago fire. But he started manufacturing sleeper cars for trains and operating them also with a near monopoly and a fantastically lucrative monopoly all across the United States, and even making inroads into parts of Europe, Canada, and so on. And of course, sleeper cars were a big deal back then. You couldn't fly to LA. You had to take a train, and that meant days on the railroads. And because he developed a monopoly on this, he was able to make quite a lot of money. And in fact, even the ire of some mainstream politicians, for example, Senator John Sherman said that he regarded the Pullman Company and the Sugar Trust as the most outrageous monopolies of the day. The governor of Illinois called Pullman extortionate, and so on. But that was about like what they charged the customers. Pullman raked in a massive amount of money also by taking it out of his workers, and made a lot of money. Between 1867 and 1871, they paid annual dividends of 9.5% to 12% to their stockholders, and 8% a year after that. Also, one of the things that's important about the Pullman Corporation is it was one of the first big corporations. There's this wave of corporatization that happens after the Civil War, where corporations come to dominate business, life, and politics and economics in the U.S. And you know, it had a board of directors, which included luminaries like Marshall Field, who of course built the department store, or whatever, but also played a really dastardly role in the execution of the Haymarket martyrs. He also had a handlebar mustache, and never mind, exactly, and a top hat, and he liked to tie workers to railroad tracks. You know, and even during economic downturns, Pullman usually made a profit, huge amounts of profit. They had surplus in the bank all the time and everything else. But it wasn't enough for Pullman, of course, to be fantastically rich, to have a monopoly on the sleeping car business, to live in his mansion on Prairie Avenue here in Chicago, or ride around in his personalized $38,000 a year rail car, which was a lot more money back then. And it wasn't enough that he could dominate his employees in his work. He decided that he was going to build an entire town named after himself to house his workers in and watch over them like a paternalistic big brother. So he built Pullman, which is now part of Chicago. It used to be technically part of the village of Hyde Park, about 6 miles south of Hyde Park. He started building in the early 1880s. Eugene Debs called it Pullman Town. Whenever he was talking about it. And every detail of the town was engineered, designed, and monitored by Pullman or his corporate lackeys. Even the human waste from the town was sent by a pipeline to a farm owned by Pullman so he could use it as a fertilizer. Thanks. He built an ornate opera house in the middle of the town that he charged, and also a library that you had to pay like $2 or $3 a year to use, which was again a lot of money back then for the workers. So none of the workers could use the opera house or the library that he built in the town. Housing was also organized in his town to closely mirror your employment status. Executives or higher-ranking employees got to live in like nice big townhouses or mansions. Middle-ranking employees lived in row houses, and like you know, the lowest-paid workers lived in tenements that were built all around Pullman Town. sale of alcohol was prohibited except at the hotel that was named after his daughter, Florence, for out-of-town VIPs. They could get a drink, but nobody else in town was allowed to drink. Unions, of course, were banned. Workers weren't even allowed to buy their own houses. They had to rent from George Pullman. You know, George Pullman, the fierce defender of the free market, would not allow his workers to buy their own houses. Nor were churches allowed to build their own churches in Pullman. Churches were forced to rent meeting space from a picturesque but expensive church that was controlled by George Pullman. And since many of the workers were foreign-born, about 72% by the time of the strike, and many of these workers were Catholic immigrants, this was, of course, an insult and a source of consternation. In fact, they also had spies in the town that were called spotters that would report weekly on the opinions and activities of everyone in town to George Pullman and to the company headquarters. In fact, there was a priest who got hounded out of town by the spotters. A priest got hounded out of town by spies, and in his last sermon in Pullman, he said, "Pullman is a capitalistic czar, a man who ruled, crushed, and oppressed by the force of money." Pullman wasn't really a town in the sense of, in the political sense of an American town in the United States, where there'd be a mayor or a city council or anything like that. Residents technically got to vote in the Hyde Park elections, but Pullman rigged the Hyde Park elections year after year by buying votes, intimidating voters. He was active in a group called the Taxpayer Party and later the Republican Party. But the day-to-day running of Pullman was totally dictatorial, just like the operation of his factories as well. There was a town agent appointed by Pullman. The public halls, where you could have public meetings, were controlled by Pullman, so labor or socialist agitators couldn't come speak in Pullman. They couldn't get a room. In fact, even moderate academic speakers weren't allowed to speak in Pullman if they might touch on the question of labor. Like, not necessarily, but if you bring it up, they weren't allowed to speak. And he also made a profit off of Pullman, off Pullman Town. It produced net revenues of 3.82% every year off of his employees. Gas cost at the time $1.25 here in Chicago per 1,000 cubic feet, but Pullman charged $2.25 to his employees. Water rates were fixed, and he averaged a profit of 150% a year on selling water to his employees. The rents were 20 to 25% higher in Pullman than they were in Chicago or Hyde Park or the towns surrounding Pullman. And company officials could enter your home at any time without warning to inspect it to see what you were up to. And when you got paid in two checks. One was your paycheck minus your rent, and the other was your a paycheck equal to your rent. And you were encouraged to just sign it over and hand it over to the bank, the Pullman Bank, which was also controlled by George Pullman and collected rents. And if you fell behind on your rent, it was simply taken out of your rent because you got sick or you got injured on the job. It was just taken out of your paycheck once you returned to work. Also, if you wanted to open up a shop in Pullman, you had to rent from George Pullman. So shopkeepers passed on the high cost of their rents to the workers again. And also, no social services were allowed in Pullman because there was no poverty in Pullman. If you were poor, you should just leave. You know, there's no reason to have elderly people there. You're not working. You know, orphans shouldn't be there because they can't work in the plants. Widows shouldn't be there, so on. So there was no social services in Pullman either, no hospital either. In fact, if you got injured on the job, you'd get taken up to Chicago or Hyde Park to get operated on or something like that. You come back, often you find you didn't have a job anymore, just a pile of medical bills. Now, Pullman believed, and it wasn't just crazy, right? It was crazy. But Pullman had an ideology behind this. He believed that social problems or the problems in society weren't the result of the way society was structured, class inequality. How could it be? Because, you know, here he is. He's rich. Everything's going well. Social problems, the problems in society had to be a result of the flawed characters of the poor and working people. He set up this town to be a sort of a paternalist. Paternalistic haven where he could correct his workers' character flaws, direct them into productive activities and so on, like the YMCA, which he was president of at the time. They were the result of weak characters, not the social inequalities of capitalism. And, you know, for a few years, he was the toast of the sort of baron, robber baron elite for his noble social experiment. Thousands of rich people toured Pullman during the Great Columbian Exhibition in Chicago, which was like the World's Fair, kind of, that give us the whatever. And tourists around the world visited Pullman, but all this came crashing down when people learned the truth about what was really going on inside Pullman Town. Before I talk, get into the meat of the strike, there's two other things I think are important factors going into it. One, in the years following, who here is familiar with the struggle for the 8-hour day in 1886? Okay, in 1886, there was a struggle for an 8-hour day. There were huge protests and strikes all around the country. They brutally repressed the strikers, executed the leaders of the movement, and so on, and trumped up murder charges in 1886. That gave us the International Holiday, May Day, International Workers' Day. After 1886, there became a standard sort of operating practice for the ruling class in the United States of brutally repressing strikers. One of the most famous of these was Homestead in 1892. Another one is, I can't pronounce French things or French things that are supposed to be pronounced in an American way, but Coeur d'Alene, thank you, Coeur d'Alene, out west, where they just massacred workers, government troops, and so on. So there's a heightening repression and increasing violence in the class struggle in the United States after 1886. The second thing, in 1893, that's important going into the strike, is the U.S. was hit by a massive economic crisis, the worst depression the U.S. had yet experienced. In 1893. Of course, there have been a lot of economic crises and also a huge economic boom over the years since the Civil War. Each boom greatly increased the size of the working class, wage workers, industrial workers in the United States by the millions, and each depression threw millions of people out of work. So there's this process by which more and more people were becoming workers every day and then thrown out of work periodically throughout this entire time period. Now, in good times, Pullman didn't pay his workers well enough, and there was all sorts of strikes here and there in the Pullman works and of course, on the railroads. But most of the time, if you didn't get hurt and so on, or get on the blacklist because you took part in a labor action, you could probably eke out a living, right, working for Pullman. It might not be a good living, but you could eke it out. The economic crisis of 1893, however, pushed Pullman workers to the wall. He started laying off his workers and reducing wages. He also discriminated against workers who didn't live in Pullman Town. So if you lived outside Pullman, you would be the first fired and last rehired when you got laid off. So workers were ordered to actually move to Pullman to retain their jobs. And while he cut wages, he did not cut rents for his workers. For example, one man who earned $9.07 over his work period had $9 in rent taken from his check and was given 7 cents on which to live. Workers' children went without school books because they could no longer afford to buy their own school books and shoes in the cold Chicago winter, which meant, you know, you didn't leave your house, and so on. And this is an example of the wage conditions. Pullman conductors were actually some of the better paid Pullman workers. They made $75 a month, but had to pay $20 to the company for food, $4 for uniform, and $6 for fines, on average, because they were constantly being spied upon by Pullman and fined for various infractions. It's like, what do they call it now, secret shoppers? Pullman would have secret shoppers to go on his cars and, and rat on his employees. Parents kept some of their kids in bed all day because they couldn't afford to feed them or heat their houses. And Pullman put poverty for all this, all these hardships affecting his workers. And he said that by even keeping his plants open in this depression, he was doing his workers a favor. But this was a lie. Pullman actually continued to make a profit during the 1893 depression. While the demand for sleeper cars fell, the operations of his existing cars, which he controlled a monopoly on, continued to make a profit. More, the company had huge surpluses from the profits of years past, enough to pay all its workers' wages for 6 months, even if it wasn't bringing in any more money, and it continued to pay dividends to its stockholders. Throughout the Depression, Pullman continued to pay dividends to his stockholders in the amounts of millions of dollars. And finally, the real reason why Pullman kept the plants open, the manufacturing plants open, was to prevent a new competitor from coming and cornering the market, right, during the Depression and taking away his business. It was better to sell a few Pullman cars at a loss than let a new company come in and take over. So concern for his workers had nothing to do with it. Like bosses today, Pullman thought you could rake in the money in the good times without sharing it with your workers, and in the bad times, it should be the workers who pay so you can keep profits up. In May of 1894, the workers decided that they had had enough. A majority of the several thousand Pullman workers at Pullmantown joined Eugene Debs' ARU. They're eligible because there was some track there, and they're sort of railroad workers and so on. They sent a delegation of workers to go to management. They got no response. Some of the time, sometimes they were given a response. There's nothing to negotiate. This is just the way it is, and so on. And they had little hope. But they decided that they had no choice. So 3,000 workers walked out and struck in the summer of 1894. And the way one worker put it, he said, "We do not expect the company to concede to our demands. We do not know what the outcome will be, and in fact, we don't care much. We do know that we are working for less wages than we'll maintain ourselves and families in the necessaries of life, and that our proposition, and on that proposition, excuse me, we absolutely refuse to work any longer." Debs went up to Pullman to investigate the conditions, and he spoke to a group of workers after he observed some of the things I described earlier. He said, "The paternalism of Pullman is the same as the self-interest of the slaveholder and his human chattels. You are striking to avert slavery and degradation." Now, as I said, they sort of struck without hope. They struck because they were up against the wall, and they felt like they had no choices left. But they started to feel some hope through their connection to the American Railway Union, the workers of Pullman. You know, they... That's not a sentence. Sorry, I need some water. Oh, yeah, yeah. All right. And so through this strike, however, on the one hand, they got hope from the ARU. Also, the ARU transformed what was the strike of a few thousand workers south of Chicago into a nationwide a railway strike in a matter of a few days. And it was a strike that sort of drew very sharp battle lines between the capitalists on one side, united with the government and the state, and on the other hand, railroad workers across the entire country. It was right after the strike began that ARU happened to be holding its first national convention here in Chicago. Delegates from the Pullman workers took their seats along with delegates from around the rest of the country. Deb spoke at the beginning of the conference, sort of set the militant tone that would imbue the rest of the conference. I couldn't think of another word. And he said, "The forces of labor must unite. The dividing lines must grow dimmer day by day until they become imperceptible. And then labor's hosts, marshaled under one conquering banner, shall march together, vote together, and fight together until working men shall receive and enjoy all the fruits of their toil." Motions were passed to, for example, indirectly support the Populist People's Party. The Populists were one of the first third-party challenges to the Democrats and the Republicans in the 1890s. Motions were made on a number of other radical things. There were motions to remove the racist proposals from the racist platforms from the ARU. They were defeated, unfortunately. As the conference went on, or the convention went on, the Pullman delegates began to speak, and they read a statement, and part of their statement said, "We struck because we were without hope. We joined the American Railway Union because it gave us a glimmer of hope. We will make you proud of us, brothers, if you will give us the hand we need. Teach arrogant grinders of the faces of the poor that there is still a God of Israel, and if need be, a Jehovah, a God of battles," which I love. And so countless delegates were moved by this, of course, and also the mood of the convention, and moved to propose that the ARU should begin to boycott any and all Pullman cars until the Pullman settled with his employees. And of course, Eugene Debs was sympathetic to this proposal, but he was also worried. The ARU was a brand new union. It was untested in battle in a large scale, and he was also worried it would provoke an all-out confrontation between the railroads and the workers, and that they weren't ready for such a big fight. So he convinced, along with the other ARU leaders, he convinced the delegates at the convention to wait on the boycott, to send some delegations to go visit Pullman and try to force a negotiation or arbitration of the dispute. Pullman executives refused to speak to anyone from the ARU that wasn't a Pullman worker, and they told the Pullman workers, again, there's nothing to arbitrate, there's nothing to discuss, yeah, we set the wages and so on, and we're doing the best, yeah, we're giving you the best we can under free market conditions and the whole thing. So they came back to the conference. Debs and the other leaders proposed, well, let's expand the strike to some of the other Pullman factories in St. Louis and Detroit and so on, but I don't know if we're ready still, you know, for the fight across the entire country. Let's give them a few days, 4 days, and if they won't negotiate by then we'll call a boycott. 4 days went by, Pullman refused to negotiate, and a national boycott was called. Rail workers across the country refused to move any more Pullman cars. The plan was that the switchman who switched the cars on a few would refuse to handle any sleeping cars. If they were fired or terminated by the railroads, then all the other ARU members on the rail line would also walk out and strike in solidarity. Pullman, of course, refused to negotiate. The union ordered all the sleeping cars to be separated from the trains, and the railroads, who are also really organized and, of course, very class conscious, they were had an outfit called the General Managers Association. They likewise refused to move any trains that did not have Pullman cars on that were supposed to. And the GMA, just to be clear, I mean, railroads today, we don't think of them as like as big of a deal as they were back then, but this was the high pinnacle of corporate America at the time. The GMA represented 24 of the largest railroads centered in Chicago, which was the hub of the railroads, with a combined capital of $818 million, which again was more money back then, and over 200,000 workers. And they wanted to exploit the old divisions, of course, to divide the strike. They tried to get the railroad brotherhoods actively scabbing during the strike, and unfortunately they did. Also, some of the highest ranks of the American Federation of Labor were lukewarm to the strike. Nationally, only the United Mine Workers offered like militant active support for the strike. And the strike was also, but there were also local unions that pledged support. I'll say something about that in a second. The strike was largely peaceful, and I need to be clear. Deb sent out instructions to people, to workers at the beginning of the strike, said, use no violence, stop no trains, elect a strike committee, and send me the name of the chairman, were the instructions from Chicago. They also spent special charges. No mail trains were to be stopped because they were worried that if mail trains were stopped, there would be a federal injunction for hindering the shipment of mail. In a few cases, strikers did stop mail trains, mostly out west, and usually only because the railroads would purposely put mail trains next to Pullman cars to cause an interruption to the shipment of mail. I said, like, the national AFL unions were largely lukewarm to the strike. Other unions and labor bodies did show solidarity. The Knights of Labor was one. The Chicago Federation of Labor offered to call a citywide general strike to help enforce the boycott. Debs and the ARU at the time still wanted to try to keep the strike as a boycott. It was focused and so on, and they turned down the offer of a general strike from the Chicago Federation of Labor. That was probably a mistake in hindsight, given the fact that there was no way to contain what was going to happen next. The companies started hiring strike breakers en masse, but their real trump card was this false claim that the strikers were impeding the mails. That was what they were hoping would give the government a pretext to use federal marshals and the U.S. Army in the end to destroy the American Railway Union. There's also an incessant media campaign to whip up this sort of belief that they were trying to destroy the mail and federal government and everything else. There were headlines. I just want to read some of the headlines from the strike. Mob is in control. Law is trampled on. Anarchists on way to America from Europe. Anarchists and socialists said to be planning the destruction and looting of the treasury. Through the lawless acts of dictator Debs, strikers, the thousands of Chicago citizens were endangered yesterday. They attacked the strike from the pulpit as well. One preacher told his congregation that boycotts are unmanly and un-American. So while all this is going on in the that's in the Gospel of Matthew. And then Jesus said, boycotts are unmanly. In the Rookery building, which is a few blocks south of here in Chicago still, the leaders of the railroads met in the GMA behind a closed door to come up with their sort of final plan to destroy the ARU. And they decided that they weren't going to hire under any circumstances, the strikers. And two, they got together and they sent a telegram to Attorney General Richard Olney, who used to be a lawyer for the railroads, asking him to appoint Edwin Walker as the special federal attorney to handle the strike. Who was Edwin Walker? He was the attorney for the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad. And Olney and Walker had already decided their plan on breaking the strike. They would use the issue of the mail as the pretext for government intervention to break it up. They would deputize thousands of special federal marshals to help break the strike as basically hired thugs that were federal agents. And in fact, they let the railroads pick these people, right, that would then be federal marshals. And then use U.S. troops. And I don't mean the state militias, but the U.S. Army to break the strike. And everything he did was designed to further this plan. And he was also a crude and violent little cuss as well. But I don't have time to talk about that. Now, there was some violence in the state, in the strike, especially in the West, and much of it was provoked by the railroads. There's also a great deal of violence that came from these federal marshals. In fact, there were cases where they would shoot unarmed people that weren't involved with the strike in any way, but would just start to get drunk and shoot people, these federal marshals. There were some riots, though usually not by railroad workers, but by the millions of unemployed people who had been made unemployed by the Depression. But even with the high unemployment, the railroads couldn't find enough scabs to replace the strikers. When they brought in thousands of troops to protect the trains, quote-unquote, to move them, they still couldn't move the trains because there weren't enough railroad workers to move them. Nevertheless, the media campaign, the conspiracy by the bosses or so on, eventually built up, and two judges in Chicago issued an injunction against the ARU, prohibiting Debs and the other ARU leaders from engaging in any action to aid the boycott. And that included just advocating the boycott. Their free speech rights were taken away, took away their ability to raise money to support the boycott or do anything else a labor leader would do. The ARU was thrown into a catch-22. If they obeyed, the strike would be destroyed, the union would be destroyed. And of course, if they disobeyed, the leadership would all be sent to jail, and the chances were that the strike would probably be destroyed as well. As Debs put it, the crime of the American Railway Union was the practical exhibition of sympathy with the Pullman employees. So they decided to ignore the injunction. They decided to ignore the injunction. They hired the famous attorney Clarence Darrow to represent them. Darrow actually was also a lawyer for the railroads, and he had to quit his job so he could represent them. But the injunction also hit rank and file workers extremely hard. Workers were arrested for not attaching Pullman cars to trains and sentenced to a week or 2 weeks in jail. Basically turning their jobs into slavery. They were ordered to do work or go to jail. And despite it all, the boycott remained solid. They called in the army to finally put an end to it, supposedly to protect federal property, although no federal property had been damaged, to prevent the obstruction of the U.S. mails, of course, even though repeatedly the union offered to send their members anywhere, to move any mail train anywhere, and of course prevent interference with interstate commerce and enforce the decrees of the court. And as I said, the strike had been almost entirely peaceful, until the army was sent in, and then it got much more violent. There were huge riots, trains were burned down, the press had a field day again, some of the headlines, Chicago at the mercy of the incendiary's torch, wild riot in Chicago, unparalleled scenes of riot, terror, and pillage, anarchy is rampant, thirsty for blood is one of my favorite, frenzied mobs still bent on death and destruction, violence on every hand, and of course, at the same time, the smear campaign on Debs kicked into high gear. He was called the son of a saloon keeper, which I'm not sure why that's an insult, because that seems like it'd be a really cool thing. And also that he was impaired by frequent intoxication, and so on. What was also interesting, despite this media campaign, most of the newspaper sellers, the young kids in Chicago, mostly boys who sold newspapers, were pro-union and supported the strike and wore the white ribbon in support of the strike, and they would throw the newspapers that were against the strike into the sewer. And when Debs and the ARU leadership were finally arrested, they were detained not by police or federal marshals, but by the U.S. Army. They looked out the window of their strike headquarters in downtown Chicago and saw the Army coming for them, even though, like I said, certainly nothing from the center of the union recommended any violence at all. only days after even the House of Representatives called for vigorous military action to stop the strike. With the ARU leadership in jail and without a secondary leadership, since the union was so brand new, the strike was rudderless. Solidarity began to wane from some of the other unions. Some of the workers in Chicago who had gone on strike to support the strike, strike to support the Pullman workers, went back to work. And while Debson was in jail, the railroad spread a rumor that the strike was over, without the union leadership being able to argue that to clarify the truth. And the strike pretty much ended at that point. When Debs was brought into Cook County Jail, just south of here, his guards showed him the cells where the Haymarket Martyrs stayed after the fight for the eight-hour day here in Chicago, and the courtyard where they were executed. And while he was in jail, both here in Chicago and through the trial, and I wish I could say more about the trial because it was one of the biggest trials in U.S. history. In fact, there was a government report after the trial. It was about 1,000 pages long that talks about every aspect of the striking trial. But when he was in Cook County Jail, but also in Woodstock Jail in McHenry County, where he served his sentence for violating the injunction in contempt of court, he received thousands of letters from workers all around the country, also pamphlets, books, visits from activists, socialists, and radicals, and he started to think more seriously about socialist ideas while he was in jail. Even when he was in jail, the populists were courting him to be their presidential candidate in the upcoming elections. And when Debs finally returned to Chicago, he was to a crowd of 100,000 workers just a few blocks south of here. It was really in jail, the result of the strike, that Eugene Debs became the Eugene Debs that we know now as one of the main popularizers of socialist ideas in U.S. history, who would later run for office, getting millions of votes, running to be president of the United States, but also saying to workers, if you're looking for Moses to lead you out of the capitalist wilderness, you will stay where you are. I would not lead you out into the promised land if I could, because if I could, someone else could lead you out. So, to end, the ARU unfortunately never fully recovered from the strike and the defeat and the brutalization of the rights of the workers by the federal government. Debs could get 1,000 railroad workers in any town to come here and speak. He was still immensely popular for standing principally with the other workers, but workers were intimidated and afraid to join up. There was a blacklist. In fact, 10 years later, there were railroad workers who couldn't get a job on the railroad because they had participated in the strike. Pullman was also never the same. George Pullman died a couple years later, thank God. But the town itself was never the same because it had been exposed as a sham. One of the things that the federal government smashed the strike, but you couldn't hide the fact of what Pullman had done to these workers in this town. Pullman was incorporated into the city of Chicago, and it slowly ceased to be the kind of dictatorship it had been before. And also, I think that the last thing I want to say is the Pullman struggle shows that workers don't necessarily go into struggle just because they think they can win. Sometimes people go into struggle because they have no other choice. And through a process of victories and defeats, and a process of developing class struggle, you can see how class consciousness can develop and fundamentally change things. And sometimes it's desperation that animates people to fight back, but in that fight they can find a hope for a different kind of world, the way Eugene Debs and thousands of other people who participated in the strike did.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.